Hi, Marco here. January will be here before we know it, and that means time is running short to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. A sincere thank you to everyone who has already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year. It truly means a lot. Your gift helps ensure that we are able to continue this crucial work. And if you haven't donated yet, now is the time. We need you. Your donation goes far beyond dollars and cents. It validates the importance of our work and enables us to tell the stories that matter to listeners like you. You're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.
Evacuated from their homes after the Hamas attacks, thousands of Israelis still wait to return. But some don't believe the current war is the answer.
We should change the language from the language of force to a language of friendship. It will take years.
The displaced Israelis living in a hotel in Jerusalem. I'm Carol Hills. Also, Russia hits Ukraine with the most significant missile attacks since the war began. And we delve into the American plot to kill a post-colonial leader in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
When the poisons were delivered to the Congo, the station chief there, Larry Devlin, asked where the orders came from. He said they came from Eisenhower.
And saving bees, even the orphans.
You can create a little bee hotel by just taking a block of wood and drilling into it.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on our last show of 2023. We begin in Ukraine, where for hours today, Russian missiles slammed cities across the country. The onslaught was the biggest Russian attack since the beginning of the full-scale invasion almost 2 years ago. A maternity hospital was hit, along with schools. An unknown number of people are still buried in the rubble. Here, emergency responders rushed to rescue people from smoldering apartment blocks that had been hit in the port city of Odessa. Official reports say more than 20 people have been killed and at least 120 others injured. To learn more about this latest attack, we called Volodymyr Solohub. He's an independent journalist in Kyiv. Volodymyr, you have sources all around the country. Describe to us the scale of these attacks and what it felt like.
According to Ukrainian officials, Russia launched almost 156 cruise missiles and drones, and they managed to hit all major cities across Ukraine, the capital Kyiv, Odessa in the south, and Lviv in the west, as far as thousands of miles away from Russian border and just 50 miles away from Polish border. I myself, I'm in Kyiv, and I woke up today in the morning from the sounds of explosions in the air. By now, we can already determine if this is an explosion from the anti-air defense hitting the target or the missile hitting something on the ground. Fortunately, the sounds that I heard were of the anti-air defense systems hitting the missile in the sky, which of course was fortunate. But many people were not as fortunate. Still, a lot of people are buried under rubble. More than 20 people have been killed. And a friend of mine who lives in Lviv, in the western part of the country, he said that the scene in that city was very similar to what we experienced here in Kyiv and in other cities. Loud bangs, explosions that roared across the entire city.
Hmm. How unexpected was this deadly barrage of missiles and drone attacks by Russia?
Well, it was both expected and unexpected. Of course, you know, living for almost 2 years in this full-scale invasion by Russia, I think every Ukrainian is expecting something like this every day. So this year, everybody was saying that something like this will happen again. Be prepared, get ready, have generators ready, have diesel ready. And, you know, one can say that we were living in this anticipation.
What's interesting is that it's been known that the Russian war machine has been somewhat depleted by the ongoing fighting. Where did all these missiles that they launched today come from?
Of course, there is fighting on the front line in the east and in the south, but the big cities were spared from these large-scale attacks. There were occasional up to 10 missiles or occasional kamikaze drones, but most of these targets were being shot down. So that's exactly what they were doing. They were waiting for the right moment. They were sparing their stock. They were amassing these rockets to wait until we are off guard or Ukraine's air defense system is not that ready. But at the same time, today's air defense worked pretty well, according to Ukrainian officials. 73% of both missiles and drones that were headed towards Ukraine were shot down.
It's almost New Year's, a time where people hope for peace and reflect on the past year. Do you have a sense of what Ukrainians are thinking about on the eve of 2024?
Obviously, everybody is hoping that this war is over as soon as possible. But at the same time, Ukrainians do not have the illusions that it'll be over soon. Unfortunately, this war looks like it will be lasting for a long time.
Volodymyr Solohub is an independent journalist in Ukraine. He's been speaking to us from Kyiv. Thanks so much, Volodymyr.
Thank you, Carol, and a happy upcoming New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too. In Kenya, this December has been a special month. Kenyans are not just celebrating the holidays, but also 60 years of independence from the British Empire. A documentary released to coincide with the anniversary looks at Kenya's surviving freedom fighters, who the British called the Mau Mau. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi brings us the story.
The documentary Our Land, Our Freedom opens with views of a lush forest in central Kenya on an idyllic sunny day. It quickly moves to something darker, the site of a colonial-era concentration camp. That's where the central character, Wanjuga Kimathi, is looking for the remains of one of the main leaders of Kenya's fight for freedom, Dedan Kimathi, who was her mother's husband and who she considers her father.
I was born in a freedom fighter's family. My mother was a freedom fighter. My father was the leader of the Kenya Land and Freedom Army. The British called them the Mau Mau.
Dedan Kimathi was executed in 1957 by the British colonial government. As Wanjuga searches for his remains, she interviews freedom fighters who survived that dark chapter of history. General Karari Njama is one of them.
I remained in the forest fighting up to June 1955, when I was shot and captured, where I met torture.
Thousands of suspected Mau Mau fighters were killed, imprisoned, or tortured during this time. The British also detained an estimated 1 million civilians in barbed-wired detention camps. 10 years ago, the British government acknowledged these colonial-era crimes and reached a settlement with thousands of Kenyans. But as this documentary exposes, many freedom fighters and their descendants remain landless, poor, and largely forgotten. Mau Mau fighter Musembi Mutia says because of that, the struggle for freedom is incomplete. We did our part, he says in Swahili. We will not be free until we get our land. Mina Nanji is one of the directors of this documentary. She says because these freedom fighters are now in their 80s and 90s, it's critical to record their testimonies and bring attention to their needs.
These are the people whose histories we should be teaching in schools. Not the name of some British general, you know, or whatever. These are the heroes of Kenya.
In the past 60 years, the plight of surviving freedom fighters has received on and off attention in local media. Successive governments have promised land to Mau Mau fighters, but many of those promises have gone unmet. Zibi Kumundu is the documentary's other director.
Our presidents, everyone is promising things, but we really hope that, you know, it's 60 years. So things have to change. It's too long. I think it's time. And I think for us, the film to come out at this time, I think is the right time for us to have discussions, really.
Discussions about how land ownership issues, which drove Mau Mau fighters into the forest, still persist today. After Kenya achieved independence in 1963, a lot of stolen land went to political elites and multinational corporations instead of being returned to its rightful owners. Fights over that land continue today. Over the course of the documentary, Wanjuga Kimathi, the daughter of the freedom fighters featured in this documentary, decides to take things into her own hands.
We have waited for freedom over 50 years. And it's not coming, and the government is not giving us. So my mom told me, Wanjuku, I'll be telling you to unite Mau Mau. Tell them to contribute money. We buy our own land.
Earlier this year, her mother, freedom fighter Mukami Kimathi, passed away. At her state funeral, Kenya's president promised to give title deeds to surviving Mau Mau fighters and to continue the search for her father, Mau Mau leader Dedan Kimathi's, remains. For The World, I'm Halima Gikondi in Nairobi.
This year, there's been an unprecedented number of migrants illegally crossing the border from Mexico. One preventative measure on the U.S. side is the border wall. Since 2019, the height of the wall that separates San Diego and Tijuana has nearly doubled. The consequence has been deadly. At least 1,000 migrants have been hospitalized with serious injuries. 23 people have died. Gustavo Solis of KPBS in San Diego spoke to trauma doctors who say this is creating a public health crisis.
When Dr. Alexander Tenorio began his residency program at UC San Diego Health, he didn't expect to see a lot of migrants and asylum seekers. After all, he specializes in brain surgery. But then he covered a couple of shifts in the trauma unit.
I just started noticing all these brain and spinal cord injuries from migrants coming in. And the reason it stuck with me is because my parents, you know, they're immigrants. They crossed the same border. So that was very personal to me. So I started just looking into it.
These patients had something else in common. All of them had fallen from the San Diego section of the border wall. Tenorio saw broken backs, collapsed lungs, and severe brain trauma.
Once you get above 10 feet, that's when you start seeing these injuries that look like high-energy car accidents.
UC San Diego Health is on pace to receive more than 360 border wall-related hospital admissions in 2023, a new record. In fact, the hospital has seen a record number of border patients every year since 2019. That's when the Trump administration increased the border wall height from 17 feet to 30 feet. And the numbers just keep going up.
So in 2018, only less than a dozen patients falling off the wall with serious injuries. Now it's, 340 or plus a year, or at least two a day.
Dr. Jay Doucette is head of the trauma unit at UC San Diego Medical Health Center in Hillcrest. He's been on the front lines of this epidemic since the beginning.
Before, we might see a foot fracture or leg fracture. Now we're seeing everything. Severe brain injuries, crushed chests, pelvic fractures.
This impacts the entire hospital system. Median cost per patient is almost $300,000. The vast majority of those costs are paid for by taxpayers, mostly through the state's Medi-Cal system. These cases also required highly trained specialists who are already overburdened with patients. Doucette says people needing spinal surgery are particularly impacted.
There are very few spine surgeons available in San Diego, and the waiting time for all patients, not just border wall patients, but for anybody in San Diego who has a spine fracture, they're now waiting twice as long as the national average to get their fractures fixed.
Both Drs. Tenorio and Doucette have been sounding the alarm, trying to get people in positions of power to recognize this as a public health crisis. Tenorio was even an expert witness for Congress at a Homeland Security Committee hearing in July.
Ultimately, these raised border walls have resulted in a record number of traumatic injuries, increased severity and mortality, and increased economic burden to our hospital systems.
Doucette has spoken with elected officials at all levels of government.
They're all very concerned, but unfortunately, nobody seems to have any answers to it.
He says today's political climate plays a significant role.
It's obvious when talking to representatives, it's a radioactive issue. Nobody wants to talk about the wall. The increase in injuries has occurred through two different administrations, and neither of them want to talk about this.
Both doctors plan to continue researching the issue and advocating for solutions. They're already collaborating with trauma doctors in Texas and Arizona to get an idea of just how widespread this problem is. For The World, I'm Gustavo Solis in San Diego.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Patrice Lumumba was a major figure of post-colonial Africa. What's today known as the Democratic Republic of Congo gained independence from Belgium in 1960. Lumumba became the country's first prime minister. But his tenure was short. Less than a year later, he was captured by forces loyal to Congolese Colonel Joseph Mobutu, later known as Mobutu Sese Seko. The moment was broadcast by British Movie Tone News.
As for Mobutu's troops, they yelled and danced with joy. They had won a great victory. They had got Lumumba after trying to lay their hands on him for months.
Several months later, Lumumba was executed. For decades, speculation swirled that there were others involved in Lumumba's death. A new book implicates the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. The book is The Lumumba Plot, The Secret History of the CIA and a Cold War Assassination. We're joined now by its author, Stuart Reed. Stuart, briefly, who was Patrice Lumumba?
Lumumba was the first democratically elected prime minister of the colony that used to be the Belgian Congo and then became independent on June 1960. And he was a nationalist who believed in a strong, independent, and united Congo. And he was an incredibly charismatic politician who was extremely short-lived in office.
And this is also at the height of the Cold War, 1960. Lumumba is a young leader trying to build momentum for this newly independent country. And he's looking for friends on the world stage. Who does he court?
So just a little bit of background. Within days of independence, the country falls into a grave crisis with an army mutiny, a secession, total chaos. And Lumumba calls on the United Nations for help, but quickly grows frustrated by their inability to put the country back together. And so it's at that point that he goes to the United States, hat in hand, and gets rebuffed by the Americans. And then, and only then, he turns to the Soviet Union for help. And that, in the Cold War context, proved to be a fatal mistake.
Why did the U.S. rebuff him?
The United States was wary of Lumumba. It had been listening to Belgian opinions of Lumumba for months now at this point in the summer of 1960, and had decided that he was unreliable and erratic and potentially pro-Soviet. And so it viewed him as not a reliable partner and sort of misjudged him, in my view, thinking that he was more cozy with the other side than with the Americans. But if you actually look at the evidence, he was more pro-American than pro-Soviet. He wanted to send Congolese children to American schools, not Russian ones. He even asked the United States to send American troops to Congo at the height of the crisis, hardly something that could have pleased Moscow. But he was just sort of misjudged, and fundamentally, the United States couldn't differentiate between his anti-colonialism, his anti-Belgian views, and something else of anti-Westernism, which he was not.
So Lumumba was put under house arrest in October and then executed in January 1961. You think the CIA was directly involved in that critical period from the time that Lumumba was put under house arrest to when he was executed?
The CIA was trying to kill him while he was under house arrest. It was unable to do so. And then in December 1961, Lumumba is caught after escaping house arrest with the help of the CIA. And here's where the CIA plays a critical role. And the timing is important here. December 1960, the Eisenhower administration is on the way out. The Kennedy administration is going to take power in January. And so there's a real fear on the ground in Congo that Lumumba might be freed from jail and brought back to power, because there are signs from the Kennedy administration that it might take a more pro-Lumumba stance than the Eisenhower administration. And so Mobutu, who's in charge at this time, informs Larry Devlin, the CIA station chief, that he's going to send Lumumba away to his death. This happens in January 1961. So Devlin, the CIA station chief, when he hears this news, he does two things. One, he doesn't try and talk Mobutu out of this plan, even though he knows that it will result in Lumumba's death. And two, he deliberately keeps CIA headquarters out of the loop because he understands correctly that if he tells them about what's about to happen, he'll be told to put the brakes on the operation because there are to be no new big decisions in the Congo during the transition. These are questions for a new administration. So Larry Devlin essentially gives a green light to Mobutu to send Lumumba away to his death. And on January 17th, 1961, Lumumba's flown to the breakaway province of Katanga, tortured the whole way there, and then driven to a remote clearing in the forest and shot dead by a Congolese firing squad answering to Belgian officers who in turn were under the authority of the breakaway provincial government there. And 3 days later, Kennedy is inaugurated.
Now, I want to fast forward more than 60 years to now. It's interesting because the Democratic Republic of Congo is also, it's not the Cold War, but it's another kind of international game around it because it's so mineral rich. Who are the players in terms of who wants access to those minerals?
So the Democratic Republic of the Congo produces something like 70% of the world's supply of cobalt, which is a key ingredient in lithium iron batteries that will power the clean energy transition. So certainly there's a lot of outside interest. A lot of the mining interests are Chinese, but I think there's been a lot made of Chinese and Russian influence in Africa, and some of that is certainly real. But I think it's also important to put it in perspective. The mistake America made during the Cold War was to see Soviet influence everywhere in Africa and think that in Congo the Soviets were extremely active and behind every action that Lumumba took. Today, likewise, there's a risk that we can think that China and Russia, to a lesser extent, are extremely active and competent in Africa. One statistic here stands out. The United States has something like 27 military bases in Africa. China has just one and Russia has zero. So I think for all the talk of Russian and Chinese influence today, it's important to put that in perspective and remember that Congo, like other African countries, is much more focused on its own development and progress than on somebody else's geopolitical rivalry.
The U.S. is now trying to get more access to Congo. Is it succeeding in courting Congo in terms of meeting its development needs?
I think the United States is still the preferred foreign partner in the Congo compared with China and certainly compared with Russia. And the Congolese are remarkably pro-American. You know, I would have expected they'd be more anti-American given what Washington did to it during the Cold War. But it's like much of sub-Saharan Africa. It has a fairly pro-American population and the U.S. is held in good standing there. I think American policy toward Congo has been more focused on stability than on democratization in the past. So in 2019, the United States endorsed Tshisekedi's election, even though almost everyone agreed that he had not won the election. So it's a difficult balance, though. The United States is trying to promote development in the Congo, but also prevent it from spiraling into the conflict that it endured in the 1990s and early 2000s.
Stuart Reed is the author of The Lumumba Plot, The Secret History of the CIA and a Cold War Assassination. He's also executive editor of Foreign Affairs. He's been speaking to us from Montclair, New Jersey. Thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you for having me.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. Taiwan's cuisine is often overlooked as other regional foods such as Chinese dominate the scene.
Identity plays such a huge important part in understanding our food culture, and having a distinct Taiwanese cuisine, that wasn't a concept 20, 30 years ago.
This Taiwanese chef hopes to change that through her cookbook. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In October, after the Hamas attacks, nearly 200,000 Israelis were evacuated from areas near Gaza and Israel's northern border with Lebanon. Nearly 3 months on, despite continued Israeli military operations, it's still not safe for most of them to return. Rebecca Collard takes us to a hotel in Jerusalem that hundreds are currently calling home.
It's Christmas lunch at the Olive Tree Hotel in Jerusalem, and it's not the usual crowd. This time of year, hotels here are usually filled with tourists and pilgrims who've come to celebrate Christmas in the holy cities where Jesus was born and died. But this year, Israelis are lining up for the lunch buffet.
2 months, something like that. No, 2 months and a half.
Bita Marilia pushes her 3-year-old son, Roy, to eat more vegetables, but he just plays with the spaghetti and rice on his plate. Marilia came here with her husband and 4 children. Since then, she's given birth to a 5th child.
We never believed that it takes so long. I remember when we come here, we say we come for something like a week, and after that, if you want to come back, so we come back. And we never realize that it takes so long.
Almost everyone in this hotel is from the southern Israeli city of Sderot, one of the poorest cities in Israel. Sderot was synonymous with rocket attacks from Gaza long before October 7th.
It's kind of funny, but we used to the rockets. It's awful to say that, but we used to.
But the October 7th attack was different. Palestinian militants entered Sderot, killing dozens of people, many in a shootout at the local police station. The gunmen are gone, but the rocket barrages continue. And so some 30,000 people have been evacuated from Sderot. Most here say they won't go back until the rockets stop.
I can suffer being out of my home a lot of time. In one condition, when we go back, there is no rockets at all.
Daniel Ben-Simon is a former member of Israel's parliament. He taught at a college in Sderot and has written several books on Israeli politics.
Unfortunately, this war revealed the fact that they cannot live there. They cannot raise their kids in Sderot. Nothing works for them. Nothing works.
Shalom Salam Lounge. Lobby Shalom Salam.
The main floor lounge at the Olive Tree Hotel now looks more like a living room than a hotel lobby. Older women knit, and some do a yoga class led by volunteers. Moshe Hassoun is usually a toolmaker in Sderot. He says it took days for the Israeli authorities to evacuate them, and it's been 2 months of uncertainty and no work since. He says many people in Sderot don't have the means to live somewhere else.
It's actually economic also. You cannot move like that in Israel. It's not the same if you sell house in Sderot. You cannot buy a house in Jerusalem. Or.
Are you surprised that that it's more than 2 months of military operations and it's still not safe?
Yes, of course. It's a very hard war because we have one hand behind the back because all the civilian people don't move and let us make war against terrorists.
In the basement of the hotel, in what is normally a conference room, there is now a daycare. Children play with donated toys. Sarit Ezra has been working here for the past 2 months.
So this hotel is called Etz HaZayit, the Olive Tree. So we call our kindergarten the Olive Tree Kindergarten.
She says she can see the impact on these children of life in Sderot.
They play and then one of the kids said, Tzeva Adom, which means you have to go quickly to the bomb shelter. Red Alert, exactly. So one of the kids said, and then all the kids come quickly, and they go like going and they hide under a table. So even though here we're in Jerusalem and everything's really calm, it's already part of the playing.
Daniel Ben-Simon says military might and the destruction of Gaza won't bring Israeli security.
Israel based its philosophy on one major thing, that our neighbors understand only force. We can coexist with them only by showing that they cannot beat us. So anything they did, we kind of used the strong arm against them.
Do you think this military operation now in Gaza is going to bring security and safety and like a normal way of life to people in Sderot?
The short answer is no. And I think we should change the language from the language of force to a language of friendship. It will take years.
For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard, Jerusalem.
Favorite cookbook lists for 2023 have been compiled, and one has already become a family favorite in my household. It's called Made in Taiwan, Recipes and Stories from the Island Nation. It's written by Clarissa Wei with Ivy Chen. I spoke to Clarissa when the book came out last fall. I started by asking her what makes Taiwanese cooking so distinct from other cuisines in the region, like Chinese.
It's completely distinct. And I didn't know this until I embarked on this research process. And I found that Taiwanese food, we have our own condiments, our own flavor profiles, our own ingredients. And by virtue of being an island, we've been a self-ruled democracy for many years. Our cuisine has evolved to be our own. We're not Chinese, and we're not anything other than Taiwanese.
I know you wrote this cookbook in part because China looms so large over Taiwan in the way you're referring. There is this geopolitical aspect to your writing. It's food, stories, and identity, too. I mean, you grew up in California. You now live in Taiwan. Explain how important identity is to Taiwanese food.
It's very important. I think growing up in LA, I sort of conflated Taiwanese food with Chinese food, and that's in part because in the 60s and 80s, when my parents were growing up in Taiwan, Taiwan was under martial law and put under the jurisdiction of an authoritarian government. And people here were told that they were Chinese and were one day going to take back China. This is during the Chinese Civil War. But then Taiwan transitioned into a democracy in the 80s and 90s. And then the sense of Taiwanese identity really became a thing. It became very distinct. And with that came a rise of awareness of what Taiwanese food is. And so identity plays such a huge, important part in understanding our food culture. And having a distinct Taiwanese cuisine, that wasn't a concept 20, 30 years ago, but it very much is the reality here in modern day Taiwan.
I want to get back to the food now. I understand there's a lot of influence from Japan, and this is because of the brutal handover when China turned Taiwan over to Japan in 1895. Tell us briefly about that, but then how it expresses itself in the food.
Yeah, that era was really fascinating and a very transformative era in our culinary scene, because what the Japanese did is they modernized all of our factories and industries. They were the ones who sort of built a train, a railroad track, and connected Taiwan from north to south. But in regards to our food, they sort of monopolized a lot of our key industries. So the way that Taiwanese soy sauce, vinegar, and wine, among other ingredients, are made today are still made with Japanese-era recipes. So our soy sauce is actually more similar to Japanese soy sauce than it is to Chinese soy sauce. Our black vinegar is more similar to Japanese-style Worcester sauce than it is to Chinese black vinegar. And sort of, again, going through these building blocks of our cuisine and finding the similarities with Japanese cuisine was kind of mind-blowing to me. And it kind of explained why in America, when I was trying to make some of these recipes but using, you know, Chinese ingredients like Shaoxing wine or light and dark soy sauce, why the dish did not taste exactly the same. I mean, it was similar, but there was something off. And it was really, it's really because of the influence of Japan that we have a unique pantry. But most people outside of Taiwan are not aware of that. With the diaspora, like my family, when you move abroad, you're not thinking about what you want from home. You're just trying to make do with what you have and what you can get at your local supermarket.
Clarissa, you're Taiwanese American, born in Los Angeles, grew up in California. What was your own upbringing like when it came to food and cooking?
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I was born in a family of gluttons. My parents brought me to Taiwan every single year during winter break from the age of 2 to 18. And all they did was eat. We're from the South, which is the street food capital of Taiwan. And so my relationship with Taiwanese food formed at a very early age. And some people, some of my friends here in Taiwan are surprised that I know of certain dishes that they even did not know of. And it's just because my parents loved eating street food.
I want to turn to one of your recipes in the book. It's called Quick Seafood Congee. We'll post the recipe at theworld.org. This is a dish your mother makes, and I understand it's a family favorite. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this was a dish that my great-grandmother loved as well. It's really simple. I think most variations of congee, you have to boil rice for a long time, over an hour, and then you add sort of whatever ingredients you want at the very end. But this one is you just take leftover rice, you put it in a broth. It could be a light sodium chicken broth, and then you throw in seafood. Taiwan is an island, so we have an abundance of seafood. So it was kind of, you know, the leftover kitchen sink assortment of the day, and it comes together in 10 minutes. And it's served, you know, at the peripheral of wet markets in the morning, and it's very hearty. You can add celery inside for crunch, and I love it because it's simple and it sort of represents how simple Taiwanese cuisine can be. And I love the seafood aspect because I think a lot of people forget that we are an island and we're surrounded by ocean and have an abundance of seafood available. So it's a family favorite and anyone can make it. You just have to have leftover rice and some seafood in the refrigerator.
Clarissa Wei is co-author of the new cookbook, Made in Taiwan, Recipes and Stories from the Island Nation. Thanks so much, Clarissa.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we've put that recipe for quick seafood congee up on our website. Check it out at theworld.org. The holiday season is a time for coming together with family and friends, of gift-giving and festivities, and for many, a time for traditions. Christians in Iraq have been trying to preserve one linguistic tradition, the ancient Syriac language. The World's Sara Hassan visited a new Iraqi television station in Baghdad that's trying to do just that.
In a small church in Baghdad, a couple of dozen people have gathered for prayers on a sunny Sunday morning. They stand in pews facing a crimson-colored curtain and a podium with a gold Syriac cross on it. The distinctive cross has a total of 12 circles at its points to represent the 12 disciples of Jesus. What you're hearing is the ancient Syriac language. Today, it's spoken mostly by Christians in Iraq and neighboring Syria. The language traces its roots to Aramaic, which was the script of the original Christian Bible and spoken by Jesus Christ. It's part of the family of Semitic languages in the Middle East region. But Syriac has been disappearing, with fewer and fewer people speaking the language. Now, a newly launched television channel, funded by the Iraqi government, is hoping to change that. The official languages of Iraq are Arabic and Kurdish, but the government launched Al Syrianiya in April to help preserve Syriac. The channel has about 40 staff and can be viewed in Iraq and around the world through satellite networks. It's a sister station of Al Iraqiya, an Arabic television network that was set up in the country after the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003. It also broadcasts in Kurdish and Turkmen. The news bulletins are read in classical Syriac, but many of the channel's other programs are presented in a dialect of the language. These include cinema, art, history, cultural events, and music. Jack Anwia is the station director. They have daily segments like news and morning shows, says Anwia, and also documentary programs about the history of the church and historical sites. He says they also play classical Syriac songs and music, top movies, and they have correspondents reporting from the field. Today, Syriac is still spoken in homes, at some schools, and during church services, mostly in the northern Kurdish region. The earliest written records of Syriac date back to the 1st or 2nd century BC. The use of the language reached its peak between the 5th and 7th centuries. Then, with the rise of Muslim conquests, more people in the region began to speak Arabic. This led to the eventual decline of the use of Syriac, but it remained prevalent in religious texts.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets.
In 2003, President George W. Bush announced the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. At the time, the country was home to about 1.5 million Christians. Since then, that number has dropped to about 400,000. Many fled during the war. Much of the decline also followed the onslaught of ISIS in 2014 that targeted Christians and other minorities. Once many of the families settled down in other countries around the world, they lost touch with their language as they tried to assimilate. Father Kasha Shamon is a priest at the Ancient Church of the East in Baghdad.
They stay there because their sons and daughters born there. They learn the culture of their countries. So it's too difficult to they come back to Iraq.
Shamon says the security situation has improved in the country over the past several years, but the community is so small that it's hard to bring people together for programs.
I have one family. If he wants get his family to the church, he has to drive for a couple of hours.
Hundreds of Syriac books and manuscripts have still survived decades of war and migration. In fact, right before ISIS fighters captured large parts of northern Iraq in 2014, the Chaldean Catholic Archbishop of Mosul rescued a collection of centuries-old Syriac manuscripts as he fled. Many of them are preserved at the Digital Center for Eastern Manuscripts in Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish region, which is supported by UNESCO and other groups. Back at the news station, Jack Anwia says that it's important not to lose Syriac. He says that Syriac is one of the oldest languages of Iraq and that it needs to be protected from extinction. El Syrianiya is one step toward that preservation, an attempt to keep the diverse traditions of Iraq and its ancient history alive. For The World, I'm Sara Hassan, Baghdad, Iraq.
I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. The buzz about bees is not good. Nature's best pollinators are under threat from parasites, climate change, and loss of habitat. But there's growing hope that research can reverse the worldwide decline in bee colonies. An American entomologist has devoted his career to studying bees and the forces that threaten them around the globe. Samuel Ramsey is a professor of entomology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's known among beekeepers as Dr. Sammy, and he joins us now. Dr. Sammy, a quick reminder for us, why are bees so important to the ecosystem?
Oh my goodness. Bees are absolutely incredible at pollinating plants. And because so many of the plants they rely on support ecosystems and support our economies through sustaining our food security, it's just really hard to overstate the value of bees to our world.
How has the year 2023 been for bees?
It's safe to say it hasn't been the best. Because what bees produce is so important, we have to also recognize that it's also very biologically important to creatures that are not us. Honeybees produce wax, they produce pollen, propolis, honey, and even the brood that's in their colony is a great resource for other organisms. And so there are creatures, primarily parasites, that get into honeybee colonies and can cause a lot of havoc because they want that same set of resources that often we are really, really, really happy about having ourselves. So there is a parasite that's moved outside of Southeast Asia, is very, very, very damaging for honeybees and potentially other species of bees as well. And we now have evidence to suggest that this organism has made its way as far as Ukraine now, and that is really concerning. Ukraine is an important source of bees for other parts of the world, and this could allow these organisms to spread much, much faster than we would be prepared for at this time.
Hmm. So before this current parasite that you're concerned about, were the parasites that went after bees less threatening?
They were pretty darn threatening. The one that we are most concerned about right now, like our current threat, is called Varroa destructor. It's a parasite that's present in the vast majority of colonies throughout the world, and it lives up to its name. I mean, Varroa destructor is not a name that you just show up with one day. Its level of havoc that it's wrought on honeybee populations is absolutely legendary. This parasite liquefies the bee's liver and sucks that out of their body, and I don't have to really stress too much to people just how damaging it would be. For honeybees, it's pretty bad. And to know that there is a parasite potentially worse than this one that is already spreading and could potentially lead to a pollinator pandemic is something that people do not want to hear.
So what makes you hopeful that the decline in bee colonies can be turned around?
I'm really glad that you asked that, because this is the time of year where we really need to be thinking about hope for the future. We have researchers now in this new crop of scientists who are studying things like honeybee genetics and looking into the potential to use new advances like CRISPR to kind of build a better bee with the levels of genetics that we have seen in Southeast Asia that have promoted such great health in honeybees in their ability to combat parasites, taking potentially some of those genes and moving them over to Apis mellifera through some of the remarkable measures that we have at our disposal that were not available to us a decade or two prior to this.
So do bees exist everywhere on Earth? Are they something that's essential for any environment?
Bees are the linchpin for so many different ecosystems, primarily because they have such a deep connection with flowering plants. And flowering plants make up the vast majority of plants on this planet. And so their ability to pollinate these plants allows these plants to reproduce, produce large amounts of fruits and vegetables and things that sustain not just human life, but so many other animals. And so they are staples of the ecosystems throughout the planet. And you really find them anywhere where there are flowering plants.
Is there anything that each of us can do to help the bee population?
There's a lot that we can all do to help our pollinators. For one, pollinators need food. And if you can plant just 1 square foot of wildflowers in whatever space of land you have available to you, even if you're in an apartment building, hanging a garden plot outside of your window can make food available to so many different pollinators, not just bees, but butterflies and hummingbirds and so many other organisms that are essential to a healthy ecosystem. We can also house a homeless bee. I mean, foxes have holes and birds have nests, but a lot of bees don't have a place to lay their head. And there are ways that you can create a little bee hotel by just taking a block of wood and drilling into it with a drill of various diameters. And you can create little spaces for bees to go in at night and sleep. They can build out nurseries where they will raise their offspring. It's great that there are so many things that we can do just on a regular basis. I'm hoping some people out here will rewild their lawns. I mean, at the end of the day, you don't have to cut the grass as much, and you've got plenty of pollinators that are constantly benefiting from you not having to cut the grass. It's a great system. Win-win.
So the little home bee hotels, it's like Airbnb without charging.
Oh my gosh, I love that. Can we? All right, I'm going to check online to see if anybody already has that. But me and you, we can go into business together selling Airbnbs. I like this. I like this.
So for this program, The World, this is our last chance in 2023 to look for hope. That's why we called you. As we dive into the new year with war and poverty and, yes, parasites, what gives you hope for what lies ahead?
What gives me hope for what lies ahead is that there are a generation of people growing up right now who have greater access to science than has ever existed in this space. I see so much educational content available online through all of these different platforms like Khan Academy and Crash Course. And I've been traveling around the world working on the research that I conduct about honeybees. And I keep meeting kids. They're excited to talk about black holes. They're excited to talk about honeybee parasites. They're excited to talk about deep sea creatures. And it's just wonderful for me to see the level of access that's growing at this point as we look at the resources available to us and figure out how to create a more just and equitable world. So seeing that and recognizing that many of the problems that we have are diverse, and now we have a greater diversity, even socioeconomically, of individuals with access to science, I have a lot of hope that the world is going to change for the better as things progress.
Samuel Ramsey is a professor of entomology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's been telling us about challenges confronting honeybees and people and how he holds on to hope for the year ahead. Dr. Sammy, thanks and Happy New Year.
Thanks so much to you as well and Happy New Year.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Happy New Year. And we'll see you back here on Monday.
Before we go, Marco here with a quick reminder. Time is running out to donate to our fundraiser and help us unlock a $67,000 matching gift. If you've been meaning to donate but haven't yet, we need you to step up now. Your gift will help sustain our newsroom into 2023. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.